Good morning, everyone. Thank you for being here promptly on time, especially after I'm sure you guys had a late night last night. Welcome back. This morning we are presenting two track sessions. This is the industry vertical track that we'll be doing for the next three presentations. We'd like to thank our sponsors. Without their support, this event would not be possible. Please take the time to visit with the sponsors and exhibitors in the break area in room 214. And if there are people you haven't talked to yet, there's some really great technology in there. So I highly recommend that you go by and say hello. We'll have our first break at 10:40 and lunch at 12:25. Breaks and lunches will be served in the exhibits area, room 214. Wi-Fi is provided by the Shaw Center, as I'm sure many of you have already taken a look at those charges. You will find additional information on page 7 in the conference program. There's free public Wi-Fi in the lower atrium only. Conference presentation slides and audio are being posted to the conference website. Log-on information is on page 7 in your conference program. One additional announcement, the CMUF website, if you happen to be trying to go out there and take a look at that today, it is currently down due to some weather problems. We're working on getting that fixed, and hopefully, by tomorrow afternoon, it will be back up again. But the conference website is still up. There's no problem. It's just the CMUF website. ICMC is developed by the commercial cryptography community. If you're interested helping to plan next year's ICMC, please let us know and stop by the registration desk. And it is really fun. It's a great way to get to know some of the organizers. Your feedback is important to us. This afternoon, we'll be sending you an email with a link to a survey. Please take a moment to let us know about your experience, what you like and what you don't like. So this morning, I am very pleased to welcome Matt Landrick, who is from Cryptomathic, and he's going to have a great presentation for us. And I'm glad to see that everyone's coming in now. We're all very excited to hear your presentation. Please come up.
All right, good morning, everyone. It's nice to see you all here. I'd like to just initially thank the ICMC, and that means probably most of you, for letting me do this presentation. Thanks for having me. Also, thanks to many of you for a fun evening yesterday. I think that was a nice arrangement. A few words about me. My name is Matt Landrock. I run Cryptomathic's North America office. I live out in San Jose, in California. I've been 20 years with Cryptomathic. Cryptomathic has been in business for about 30 years. By training, I'm a computer scientist, and I'm also a business administrator. In daily life, I spend much of my time helping clients architect secure systems. And sometimes we get to help realize them too. Yeah. So one of the things you noticed on the title of my talk is it's about crypto as a service, yet for embedded security environments. And so you might already be thinking now, well, why am I talking about the Internet of Things? And that is, as you'll see, it's because I take the perspective of the bigger system, not just the thing, but also the fact that the thing actually connects with something. And so we all know of the examples. We'll hear more about cars and security systems for cars. The examples that I love to hate, and I'm sure many of you share this sentiment, right, that we talk about the internet inside of a washing machine or a fridge or something like that. But of course it's out there and it's part of it, and I'll come back to why that is also important. But there's another very important aspect to these type of systems, whether it's the security system of a car or just the online system of an appliance. Because regardless of what, there's some communication going on with a backend. And that backend typically sits in a data center. And if it's secured, we typically do that by throwing HSMs or hardware security modules after them. So what can we expect from embedded systems? If we split these two things up, the things from the Internet of Things, there'll be anything from PCs through phones to smart meters to dishwashers and cars. And if we abstract a little bit away from that, let's consider apps, its applications, what's running. And there are many systems out there that will help with providing embedded security. You've got TPM chips, trusted platform modules, chip cards when users tend to get involved. But it can also be various crypto providers in software. It doesn't necessarily have to be in hardware. Of course, the security goes down as we lessen the security and we lessen the hardware parameters. In phones, we heard yesterday, for instance, Global Platform talking about secure element and trusted execution environments. There have been examples of trying to secure phones, not using an onboard secure element, but using a SAM as part of the little chip that we insert in the back of the phone to get service and use that as an additional security controller. Secure chips of different sorts. So what I'm trying to get at with this is there are really a whole ton of embedded systems out there in terms of security. And some are highly secure and some are not so secure. And at the end of the day, it's going to depend on the application, of course. If we look at the data center side of things, of course, dedicated data centers is what used to be what people would operate. And I think to the extent that you're operating a very secure network, for instance, banking grade or something like that, there's going to be a tendency to stay with that, even if it sounds very alluring, moving to Amazon Web Services and Azure, et cetera. To the question of HSM, some data centers do, some data centers don't. But again, we can take the abstraction that we're looking at this system really as a series of applications or APIs that are connected with each other. So let's briefly talk about some of the techniques common to things. And whenever you see things in these little snippets, it's because that's from the Internet of Things, right? And those are the modules or the products out there that may or may not have some embedded security in it. So that could be, for instance, the need to execute a secure stack of code. You've got the BIOS, you've got the firmware, you've got an OS, you've got the app running at some level. And of course, if you have a secure chain, well, then at least you can control to some extent that whatever runs on it has at least been rubber stamped by the authority that can sign. Doesn't necessarily mean that it'll run well or that it'll work, but we'll get to that. We might also enable the thing to carry out basic cryptographic functions or operations. And as mentioned, that could be hardware-based or could not. Authentication also, of course, plays a role. We've got the things out there, and we've got some sort of central service. And of course, it's important that these things can and services can authenticate appropriately towards each other so that each knows what's at the other end. So understanding that things in the Internet of Things can mean pretty much anything security-wise from the very high end to the very low end, maybe let's try to examine the server side some more. Traditionally, one would secure central applications with HSMs, and that's because HSMs help ensure that keys do not leave the intended security zone. Of course, while that's great security-wise, it doesn't necessarily scale or deploy very fast or very practically, and so that's a challenge. As we heard yesterday, John Geeter gave a keynote yesterday from Talos, and he mentioned that, you know, when he was working with probably Samsung in South Korea, every day they get delayed with their project means not selling 375,000 phones. And so we have to, I think that's a pragmatic point of view, right? We have to realize that if security adds too much inconvenience or too much cost, then it's just simply going to be skipped. So there's always that little trade-off. Now, if we think about working with HSMs, there are a bunch of challenges. The HSMs in a system are typically, most of the time at least, are underutilized because they're rarely shared between projects. They're duplicated across systems, and so massive capacity lays dormant. And that means barriers to deploy, because there's a lot of cost involved, but only upfront. But also, then once you've got it up and running, it's all great. But getting to that point that you're up and running, that takes tremendous effort. Crypto APIs tend to be complicated. There's a steep learning curve. Many of you in this room will have worked with crypto APIs, and I'm sure you'll recall that it took a while getting used to. And of course, one thing that we often tend to forget is that it's very possible to write code that works but is insecure. And that, of course, means that, well, we should consider auditing, and that's a common measure. But auditing is something that's ongoing and is an additional overhead, which is not only a cost but also a nuisance. And if you want to go in and you do want to change some rules, and I'll give you a practical example, in the banking space, for instance, they would migrate from DES to triple DES, and some are beginning to migrate from triple DES to AES, and they might go from AES 128-bit to AES 256-bit at some stage. So you do have, in large enterprise deployments, you do have these generations of things. And so any change across the board is going to be a ton of new projects. Another issue is key management is often overlooked. I think not because people want to overlook it, but because it's a little bit of a hard problem. We just tend to assume that when we're using crypto, that there's a key, and that key in place works and does what it needs. But we do like to roll them in order to ensure the ongoing security. And typically, there's not, at least in most enterprises we've seen, there's not a single view of all keys in use. And then there's, of course, finally the challenge of the application lifecycle. And I gave a few examples of that. So let's take a step back and let's look at the traditional approach and where that's a little bit challenged and what can be done to improve of that, so that we can get to these these secure deployments that work not just with the thing in the field, but also securely on the back end. So we tend to, whenever we have an application that or service or whatever that we want to secure, we start throwing HSMs at it, and we build up this monolithic silo, so to say, and we audit it, and we have operators for it, and we do this and that. And so next time when we get the next application or thing that we're trying to secure, we start from scratch and we build it all up again. So each project has siloed HSMs, and because it's so relatively complex, in reality very few applications get secured with HSM grade security, and I think that's a shame. I'll come back to what the 2% relates to in a second. So if we look at the possibility of considering crypto as a service, where we start realizing that there are hardware security modules in the back, and these are available, and if they're deployed in a smart way, well, then we can actually access the HSMs and let each application do what they need to do. If we start building a central infrastructure service, at least across an organization, we can start supporting more applications. And that's going to increase the demand for HSM capacity, while at the same time saving some of the operational overhead that would be to each project. So whereas you might go from using HSMs in, let's say, 2% of your applications, you might go to securing closer to 100% of your applications using HSMs. And I'll provide a practical example here from one client that we worked with. In the course of 5 years, they went from securing just 3 applications using hardware security modules to securing approximately 180 applications. And that's nice because, as I mentioned, this is something that scales well, and I think that's something that's increasingly important in the future that we're coming into. But some of you are probably thinking now, but hang on, wait a second. If we just let each application access a communal system, doesn't that introduce a whole new series of challenges? And of course it does, and that's why we need to design it in the right way. So how can we ensure that all applications, all things or cars out there that are on such a system, that they can receive service, yet that they can ensure that the service is only made available to them on a legitimate basis? So for instance, just going back a slide and thinking of application one, you wouldn't want application one to share keys with application three. How can we do that? And the answer is going to be through policy, and I'll come back to that. So just keep that in mind for now. So what I'll be talking a little bit about is a platform that we've built for crypto as a service. We call it Crypto Service Gateway. And we kind of build it with the following in mind. Crypto doesn't have to be complicated. A lot of cryptographic problems that we've seen happen over and over again out in the field are actually avoidable. But it does require that we rethink slightly how crypto is deployed in a business. Now, it's also a platform that helps simplify application crypto. So I mentioned the policy, and I'll come back to that. But when we start deploying policy and controlling policy by those who understand security and who are able to propagate it out onto systems, well, then we can actually cut some corners, and we can make it a lot easier to get going. So if we look briefly at how things work, it's an infrastructure that looks something like this. The calling system will send crypto commands to this service gateway layer. The crypto as a service layer will verify that the app and the users involved are allowed to perform the operation. And once it's checked that this is sanctioned, it will go ahead and it'll distribute the load and run out and get essentially provide the service. Of course, there's some administration of such a system. There's also some key management involved. And we'll come back to the key management portion. Now, as I mentioned, we're going a little bit away from silos and going to initially fewer HSMs, but then going in and actually providing a service to a much, much broader user base. Of course, we wind up with more HSMs in the long run. But so as we've already talked about, Crypto Service Gateway will share HSMs between applications. The HSMs can be added or removed without affecting service. I had one and all that up on the same slide. So we can add or join new HSMs to the system when needed, right? So imagine you've got the capability of seeing, hey, we're getting pretty close to capacity on our system. Wouldn't it be nice to just scale up on that? Maybe we need to take HSMs out. Maybe we need to do a firmware update. Maybe, as we heard yesterday in a talk, maybe the FIPS validation that we had received turned out to be a little bit broken and we needed to patch the systems. Well, then you take some HSMs down and you work on them separately while the system continues. And so what I'm getting into is, of course, monitoring and, you know, essentially looking at the system as a whole and trying to spot problems before they happen. All right. I mentioned policy, and so now we're getting a bit into some of it. You can think of crypto as a service, as kind of as a cryptographic firewall in some sense, that will only allow through specified commands. But also once it looks at these specified commands and has validated that these are legitimate commands, then of course the system also needs to look up, well, is the user allowed or the application allowed to do what's being asked? By having a central policy, we can ensure that the security decisions are in the hands of a security team. The security team will define the parameters, the permits to change these is something that can be done and can be controlled without having to change the application. And you're probably beginning to wonder how is that possible, and I'll get to that in just a little second. But if we assume that objective can be met, we can get to a point where auditing is easier. There'll be less digging through application code. It should be clear and easy to read security properties. So if we look at the policy concept I mentioned, we've got an example of policy over on the right-hand side here. You'll see there are two users in this policy. They're each called local something, and that's because they're set up locally on the system, but they could be set up on any system. They could be set up on an Active Directory service system. They could be set up to have validated themselves according to some Kerberos system. They could have been set up by validating themselves according to the mechanism that's in the embedded security system. Maybe it's PKI based, maybe it's something else. So we abstract a little bit away from this with what we call tickets. And so if you think of a user or a group of users as potentially having the possibility to get a ticket, well, the ticket is what they present as a proof that I'm allowed to carry out this operation. And so let's look at a permission setting for the online banking user in this case. Do encrypt from app to disk with parameters. And you'll see there's something here called basic AES parameters. If we go down and look a bit further down here, it says basic AES parameters. Well, that's an AES cipher. It's 128-bit key size. Something called managed, I'll get to that later, so let me just skip that for now. We'll say it's false. The mode of operation is cipher block chaining, random initialization vector, and PKCS7 padding. So what you'll begin to notice up here is we've abstracted encrypt and the parameters of what encrypt means away from each other. And that's a pretty strong thing, and I'll come back to that. Just also to keep in mind, because I'll use that later on in my presentation, we're going to do some code signing as well. And you know, where we had a from and a to relation in symmetric crypto, of course that makes less sense in asymmetric crypto. And so we just do a from. So do code sign from dev. And that might be for, you know, signing drivers that you're producing for a Windows machine, or it might be signing new software for the appliance out in the field or the car. Okay. So by having the policy, we begin to see the light at the end of the tunnel in terms of freeing up the developer from some of the challenges that the developer typically faces, where the developer often will run into trouble, subject to their skill, of course. If you've got a very experienced developer, they typically won't. But what you saw in the policy was essentially the policy portion of what we call crypto query language. And crypto query language will look something like this. So this is from the developer's perspective. Do encrypt from app to database with data. And here the example data is 1, 2, 3, 4. Or do code sign from the development on what we want to code sign. Again, for example, we'll use 1, 2, 3, 4. We might also call other HSM functionality. Give me something random. If we start deploying such a system, of course it becomes easier to do the programming, it becomes easier to audit it, but it also becomes easier to manage these things from a central point of view. And I think there's an important lesson here, because what I explained with some of our experience from the banks, where they, you know, will upgrade the crypto over time and something new comes out and what needs to be encrypted, maybe cipher block chaining mode turns out to not be optimal for the case at hand. Maybe you need to go to ECB mode or something like that. If we've removed setting the parameters from the application that makes a call into the service, well, then we have something very strong, because we can modify it along the way based on what our policy tells us. So here's a little Java code example, just to give you an idea how would this be integrated. So we see here on the first part, we'll be contacting a crypto as a service server. It's got a URI and it's got a port, and we'll be logging into it somehow to get our ticket, or we'll obtain a ticket somehow, as I mentioned before. And in this case, we're just doing it with a local logon, but could be many other things. Now it's a hello world example, which of course everyone here is familiar with, and probably over familiar with. And what we're going to do is we're just going to simply make the call that we had before, do encrypt from app to database. So essentially, we're just throwing the whole string at our Java library here, and we've got another one for decrypt, which looks very similar. You'll notice that the verb has changed from encrypt to decrypt. And then, of course, we can go ahead and we can execute the program, and we can say, here's the clear text, here's the crypto text. Now we're back to the clear text. Very simple example. Now, it doesn't have to be in Java. We've been working also with .NET and C++, adding RESTful APIs. We see that as something up and coming. You might also use a little tool for playing around. Imagine a little GUI that helps you add these things. And also, just for those of you who are programmers and don't like to use human-readable strings, of course, we could also make a call that was more object-oriented, and we're just simply passing on the data as the attributes of the object calls that we want to. Okay, so with that part of the picture somewhat in place, there's a portion that I mentioned that's very important that we often overlook, and that's key management. And key management tends to mean much more than making sure that there's a key in the right place. It's about generating keys, or if keys have not been generated on a certain system, but on another system, they need to be imported. We need to be able to export them. We need to, in certain cases, at least in the asymmetric cases, we need to be able to certify and create certificates. We need to be able to store, backup, restore, use keys. Now, keys will also have an expiry in a business setting. Of course, a cryptographic key doesn't know anything about an expiry, but in a business setting, they do. And we'll want to talk about updating them. And that means we have to start talking about version control, and we have to start worrying about how can we make all this fit together in the life cycle of the system we're trying to secure. So while the crypto service gateway provides the basis of much of the crypto as a service layer, we can think of it as taking care of using keys. Yeah, it's a services facility for using keys, but it does assume that keys have already been managed, and that's where a key management system comes into play. It might be a KMAP system, it might be another key management system. Preferably, it's some sort of centralized key management system which will be designed to replace and unify otherwise poorly designed proprietary key management systems. Because if we start thinking about it, on the HSM, we might have one type of key management system. On the embedded security devices, we might have a different type of key management system. So that's what I mean with replace and unify. Because it's nice to be able not to have to do more key management than absolutely necessary. I'm sure many of you have been involved with key ceremonies, and they're not always fun. But they are time-consuming. Okay, so what are the requirements of a good key management system? Well, to consolidate things is obviously the objective. I think one would like a central overview and management of all keys. One would like to do something to be able to reuse things. Could be introducing templates. So if we've got a group of keys that tend to be AES 128 bits, etc., then probably we'd like a template so that we don't have to redo everything every time. But probably even more important is automated key distribution. So if we're updating keys and it needs to go out to several subsets of our entire organization and systems, and some of them over the network and over the internet out to those Internet of Things, we certainly need this to happen on an automated basis, because the users aren't going to be bothered with this. When you deploy a key management system, of course, demonstrating compliance is going to be very necessary as well. You'll want tamper-proof audit logs maintained for all keys. You will want separation of duties of administrators. And of course, I should have mentioned dual use and separation of duty with administrators when I spoke about the policy. It's a very important point, of course, because the policy to the crypto as a service layer is so central to the system. You can of course go ahead and you can change behavior of the system. You can change the security of the system. So we do recommend that policies are signed by at least two signatories, and changes to them are. All right. Again, with key management system, increased usability is highly desirable. We've found over the years that many of our clients who do a lot of key ceremonies and do more and more of them tend to get a little bit sarcastic about them. They'll start dubbing them key parties because it's everybody meets getting into the same room and then doing their thing while waiting for everyone else to complete their portion. And so you often find people spending at least an hour or something like that in a key ceremony. But if you have the capability of introducing asynchronous workflows, well, then we can actually increase the flexibility. So imagine that one player of a key ceremony will log in Monday morning and do his or her share, and the next player will log into the system and do their share the next day. So if we look at key exchange and we take the view of the key management system, we can start realizing there might be different subsystems that we're pushing keys to. Maybe we're pushing keys out to a system that distributes keys to security infrastructures that are embedded into vehicles or something like that. Maybe we're just simply pushing keys to make sure that the crypto service gateway platform can operate. Maybe we're exchanging keys with third parties. Maybe we're an operator and we're exchanging keys for the cars with Toyota or somebody, or a payment scheme, whatever it might be. One thing we spoke about a little bit implicitly, and I'd like to come back to this, is you'll notice that in the crypto query language, we didn't talk about key labels. And I think that's something that most of us aren't really that familiar with, right? Because usually we have some sort of identifier for a key. And we take that identifier, and this is how we reference the key. So if we want to use this key, we reference the key by this identifier. But you'll notice there was no key label. So how do we look up keys? Well, if we think about our crypto query language example again, Do encrypt from app to database with data, or do code sign from dev with data. We'll notice that the key labels are in fact implicit. So I put up a copy of the policy on the right. So the key labels are implicit. On the first one, the user is local online banking from his app to his database. And these are just free variables, their words. It doesn't have to mean that it goes into a database. It's simply business logic. And we're trying to help make heads and tails of, you know, logically speaking, but when we think about the application that we're trying to secure, what are we doing? Why are we trying to do this? We don't necessarily need to call the key number 3. We can call the key something meaningful in that business context. So that's really what goes into key labeling. But the crypto, as also mentioned, is very implicit. It's implicit through design of the system, from the parameters. We had basic AES encryption, or CAPI CNG signing parameters. Now I'd like to come back to the little flag we had up around managed encryption. Because as I also mentioned in the beginning, over time, people will want to upgrade their crypto, but they wouldn't necessarily like to update their applications. Right? So from the application point of view, it still do encrypt from to. But we might be moving a little bit away from things. Maybe we just need to update the key. Maybe we have a policy that the key should be updated every year. Maybe we need to change the mode of operation. Maybe we need to change the key length. If we had set the flag managed to true, well, then that'd be included a little bit of header information with just enough information to ensure that the crypto service layer would be able to use the right key and use the right crypto. So we might copy the basic AES parameters section, and we might, in our policy, make a new section that we call advanced AES parameters section or managed AES parameters, which is essentially a copy of this, but we've set the flag to true. So having added this now to our policy, and maybe under the permission, we've added an extra permission that said, or we've changed the permission to managed AES parameters, up at the permission setting for the online banking user. And as we get ready to test this and move it from our test and development systems onto our production systems, of course, for each case, we have two policy signatories signing it. And that's what some of the things I meant with that the just as the policy is a very powerful tool, it's also a tool that should be protected and controlled, because it along with the convenience, of course, comes a lot of responsibility. All right, so let's try to run through some real numbers. How long does it take to develop for systems, whether it's for the Internet of Things or for apps in general? How long does it take on the server side to deploy an HSM-based and hard security system? You'll typically have some project engagement followed by some requirements capture. And these are examples from a client we've worked with in the past. For the first 6 weeks, they would, you know, get the project teams together and say, hey, we need a project group. We need to find, hey, we need to encrypt some stuff. What's the policy for that? Or let's go interview the right guys and explain them what we're trying to do. But in the case, of course, where they had such an infrastructure and such a group set up in place, that became pretty much a two-hour meeting. They didn't have to go out and acquire new hardware. Of course, the overall infrastructure team taking care of a crypto oriented services infrastructure, such as the one we've been discussing, They'll, of course, procure more HSMs when needed, and they'll be monitoring the system whenever they're adding new applications and they get high on load. Of course, they need to expand on the crypto. So it's not that the hardware procurement goes away, but it becomes part of an infrastructure expansion process. And that also helps cut things down. Then there's the deployment part. But as you recall, part of the deployment is, of course, developing and testing. And that'll also take some time. Let's say we're using PKCS11 calls as opposed to something like CQL, and we're spending time educating the developers in question. We're spending time also checking that they've done what they did, what they needed to do. We can cut some of those things away. So in one particular case that we've been working with, deployment schedules went from 24 weeks down to a week. And I think that plays into what we spoke about earlier. In terms of wanting to add security on the one hand, yet on the other hand, also wanting to release a product, regardless of how good or bad our security might be. And I think that's going to be an important point. So now, coming back to the embedded systems and the Internet of Things, I think it's very important to recall that we cannot think of anything in isolation. There has to be some sort of infrastructure around it, and it's of course online because we're talking about security for embedded systems that are online and are part of the Internet of Things. And the combined system needs to be considered. I think far too often we look only at the appliance and we think of, oh, can it give us, you know, could it potentially be used to jumpstart access to our network, or, you know, from my appliance to my PC, getting to my passwords, etc. But there's much more to it, because there's also that bigger component. I mean, if we put things online, it's because we want them to communicate with services somehow, whether it's for telling them to wait a little bit with kicking in power, or whether it's to buy stuff for us automatically, or whether it's for anything else. But there is that connected component, and that means that there is a larger system. There's the server side as well as the client side. So one pragmatic strategy is, of course, that we start contemplating only putting in as much security to the thing as is required to defend the business strategy. And what do I mean with that? Let me explain. As somebody who's worked in security for many years, I get very excited about security, and I think things should be super secure. But what I often tend to forget is that security also comes at a cost. And we've spoken about it'll come as a cost to delay to the project. It'll come as a cost also physically. We're adding chips to the system. That means engineering hours. It means the physical price of chips into the phone or into the car, et cetera. It means increased complexity. It also means increased maintenance and support on those systems, because you've got a bigger system and you've got more to look after. So if we think about what does it mean to only build in as much as is necessary, let's try to consider some of the things that are going to be important. And I'll provide a few examples, and I'm sure some of you will have your own thoughts as well. So we'll have, for instance, a trusted execution stack. There'll be some hardware that boots up somehow. Think of your Kindle e-reader or something like that. It has some hardware, it has some firmware, it has a BIOS, it has an operating system. It has applications running on there. And each layer is secured individually. So we've got that whole execution stack. And of course, code signing is incredibly important in that. regardless of which type of embedded security system we're looking at. Even if the embedded security is only emulated in software, we've still got that to worry about, because we want to make sure, for instance, in the case of the Kindle e-reader, Amazon wants to make sure that they determine who gets to write software and who gets to put software on it. They want to avoid malicious software. Again, as mentioned in the beginning, it doesn't necessarily mean that the quality is going to be any good, right? It's a rubber stamp. So if we have a trusted execution stack, it's all it means is that we trust those who provide it, and we can entrust them with it. But there's also another component. There's the authentication between the client and the service, the ability to establish the secure connection. And that can, of course, be either through message security or through some security protocol. But essentially enabling the client to, in some cases, send a message to the service and say, hey, I am so-and-so, and for the service to be able to validate that, or in other cases, for the client, whatever that thing is, to be able to validate this is the service I was supposed to speak with. So crypto as a service can create such a balance, and it helps fill many gaps that might otherwise be left unfinished. Thank you. And I think with those words, we'll move on to taking a few questions. Thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thanks for your presentation, very interesting. I'm thinking as a service, this is like needs to be a must, like in Zoom. Even our own company where I work, a telco, it's very difficult to get key certs, whatever, on devices that are out there and get them properly implemented and having the client actually properly interact to achieve that cause. I'm wondering, do you think this is, I mean, a cloud service where properly implemented design clients to be able to request keys and certs properly done can actually do what you were saying, as in this number of weeks with, I'll say, legacy HSM type environments to a cloud service to this amount of weeks, if it's done properly? Do you think that's realistic? That's really able to be, I'll say,
yeah,
produced?
No, that's a great question. So what we've seen is when deploying such a system as this, whether you're building it yourself or you're buying a system out there, deploying it is the first time for the first application you're going to use is no easier or no more difficult than deploying any other system with a hardware security module or with hardware security modules enabled. You've still got that whole thing to go through, right? Because you need all the basic infrastructure to set it up and to start running. But the thing is, once you're up and running and you've set up, like maybe you've set up a line for development and test purposes, you've set up another one for QA purposes, and finally you've set up a third line for production and DR. So setting those up the first time is going to take you, the regular at least 24 weeks, and in some cases we've seen it also take 24 months. But yeah, it depends a bit on the maturity of the organization deploying them. But the funny thing is, next time you get to the point where you need to have application number two come onto your system, well, that's when you have all those things ready to scale, because you've already got the infrastructure ready. So getting that new project onto to the development system is simply as easy as modifying the policy and as explaining to the developers, these are the calls we've prepared for you, and of course setting up the right keys, right? Because you've got to set up the keys to go with the calls. But that is really, I mean, that becomes, a few hours of work, including getting the key managers, so to say, or key custodians to do their work. So you don't get the scale to answer your question. You don't get the scale to begin with, but you get it after you've begun.
How many iterations do you think that you need to get there? I mean, once you have the hardware, software, I'll set a framework in place to get them to properly implement.
Mm-hmm.
How many iterations do you think is required to get down to that amount of short amount of weeks?
Yeah, you probably, I don't know, need 5 to 10 projects or so.
Okay.
It'll depend also very much on the skill level of the people running the
great
service. Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. We're out of time. All right. I'm available. I'll just go out here. And you're welcome. Thank you very much, everyone.
That it's in order. Make sure those are A, C, just in case. Nope. Okay. Go ahead. And since I don't have a bio for you, I assume that you will.
Okay.
You can introduce
yourself.
Great. Sorry.
Okay.
No problem.